everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. I think that I exist. Not everyone agrees. Who or what are you, really? Are you the same person over time? Or is your younger self actually just a different person? Is there something that would remain constant amidst all kinds of physical and mental developments? Is there any essential you at the core that would survive any transformation over time? In philosophy, some don't think there is a self, or a person who endures over the span of a human life. Other people think there is a persistent self, someone who has the thoughts, experiences, beliefs, and so on that we have. They think that in some meaningful sense, you were one person when you were 7 years old, and today, you're the same person, albeit one who has changed quite a lot, physically and psychologically. In the past, I've avoided this question of personal identity because the nature of persons is quite opaque to me. It seemed like every specific theory of personal identity had unacceptably weird, counterintuitive implications. Every view has something going for it. They all seem kind of plausible at first, but it looked as if there would be no satisfying answer in the end. So why bother? Some views are unable to distinguish between you and a perfect clone. They have no principled grounds for distinguishing the two, even though it seems obvious that I and my clone are in some sense not the same person. Other views rule out RoboCop scenarios where a person becomes fused with an artificial body. I'd say that you still exist even if you became RoboCop. Other views imply that Socrates could have been an alligator, and we'll get into all that. But one thing that's remained constant, I've always been afraid of the teletransporter, which is a murder machine. So for those who don't know, imagine that you need to take a trip over a vast distance, say from a spaceship down to a planet, or just New York to Los Angeles. And scientists have invented a new form of transportation called the teletransporter. It's fast, it's eco-friendly, no need to go through the airport. It scans your body, and it sends a beam of energy to the location you're going, where your body is reassembled. The problem is that we're not really sure, or at least we can't agree, whether the person who comes out on the other side is really you. Does this machine transport you from one place to another? Or does it kill you and then make a replica? If it makes a replica, what will happen is my point of view will come to an end. I will go to sleep and not wake up. Someone else will wake up, and they'll have all my memories, they'll be qualitatively identical to me. Other people wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but it remains a fact that my subjective point of view will have come to an end and will never resume. But if the teletransporter doesn't kill me, then I'll step into the machine, and then I will wake up in a different location. Another famous philosophical thought experiment that bears on this is the ship of Theseus. Michael Humer likes to use this example to illustrate what philosophy is in the first place. I'm going to read a section from his book, Knowledge, Reality, and Value. Quote, "The ship of Theseus is a classic philosophical problem. Note that I don't use this example because it's such an important problem. The reason I like it is that A, it's easy to get people to quickly see the issue, and B, it is very clearly not either a scientific or a religious issue or any other kind of issue besides philosophical. Once there was a Greek hero named Theseus. He sailed around the Mediterranean Sea doing heroic things like capturing bulls, chopping heads off minotaurs, and abducting women." Standards of heroism were a bit different back then. "As he was doing all this stuff, his ship suffered some wear and tear. When a particular plank of wood was damaged or rotted, he'd replace it with a new piece of wood, just one at a time. And let's say that after 10 years of sailing, eventually, every one of the original planks of wood had gotten replaced by a new one at one time or another. So here's the question. At the end of the 10 years, did Theseus still have the same ship that he had at the beginning, or was it a new ship? Now suppose that there was someone following Theseus around all those years, collecting all the old pieces of wood as he threw them aside. At the end of the 10 years, this person reassembled all the original pieces of wood into a tattered and ugly ship. Was this ship the same as the original ship Theseus started with?" Notice how this is not a scientific question. It's not as if there's some kind of experiment you can do to figure out if it's the same ship. We could try getting a ship and swapping out its parts, as in the story, but then what would we do? Observe the ship really closely? Weigh it carefully? Observe it under microscopes? do a spectroscopic analysis, none of that would make the slightest difference. We already know the underlying facts of the case because they're stipulated. We just don't know whether those facts add up to the ship being the same ship or not. Notice also, though, that it's not as if there's nothing to say about the issue. You can see why one might think it was the same ship, and also why one might think it wasn't. It is odd to say that Theseus still had the same ship at the end of the story, since it has no parts at all in common with the original. If anything, the ship reconstructed out of the old planks seems to have a better claim to being the original ship, since it has all the same parts, in the same configuration as the original. But if we say that the ship Theseus had at the end of the story wasn't the same ship as the original, then at what point did it cease to be the same? Which plank was it whose removal gave Theseus a new ship? Presumably replacing just one plank of wood doesn't give you a different ship. So we're not going to try to resolve that question now, but that is the sort of question philosophers address. Most people in intellectual life, people in other fields, would just try to avoid that sort of question. Philosophers try to actually figure out the answer. By the way, the answer need not be one of the answers that the question straightforwardly seems to call for. It doesn't have to be, yes, it was the same, or no, it wasn't the same. The answer could be, it neither was nor wasn't the same, or it's a semantic question, or it was the same in one sense and different in another sense, or there are degrees of sameness, and the degree of sameness decreased over time. This situation is fairly typical of philosophical questions as well. Most questions in other fields of study are meant to be answered straightforwardly in the terms in which they are posed. You're generally not supposed to say the question contains a false presupposition, or has no answer, or needs to be rephrased, etc. But in philosophy, those sorts of responses are on the table. So I read that because I think it's relevant to this question of personal identity. First of all, it's relevant in a very direct way, because over time, you change physically and psychologically. And secondly, because this is a philosophical question, you can just stipulate all the facts of the case, and yet it's still not really clear what the answer is. You have to reason about it. To answer the question, you have to do philosophy. So this episode is not a systematic overview of the debate over personal identity. I just wanted to highlight a few thought experiments that I found thought-provoking that illustrate the costs and advantages of different views. I do want to explore this in more depth, but that's all we're doing for now. We'll come back to the transporter, and I also want to talk about Ralph Stefan Weir's dilemma for transhumanists. There we'll talk about mind uploading, achieving immortality by uploading ourselves to the cloud. But first we have to answer a really important question. Could you have been an alligator? It's the question everyone's asking. Fortunately, Alvin Plantinga tackles this question in The Nature of Necessity. Quote, could Socrates have been an alligator? That depends. We might think of an alligator as a composite typically consisting in a large, powerful body animated by an unimpressive mind with a nasty disposition. If we do, shall we say that any mind-alligator-body composite is an alligator? Or must the mind be of a special, relatively dull sort? If the first alternative is correct, then I think Socrates could have been an alligator, for I think he could have had an alligator body. At least he could have had an alligator body during part of his career. We have no difficulty in understanding Kafka's story about the man who wakes up one morning to discover that he has the body of a beetle. And in fact, the state of affairs depicted there is entirely possible. In the same way, it's possible that I should awaken one morning and discover to my considerable chagrin that my body has been exchanged for an alligator body. Socrates, therefore, could have had an alligator body. If this is sufficient for his having been an alligator, then Socrates could have been an alligator. Whether he could have had an alligator body all along, throughout the entire time during which he did have a human body, is of course a distinct question, but here too I'm inclined to think that he could have. End quote. Now, on the one hand, I can understand perfectly well Kafka's metamorphosis, but on the other, is there really no limit? Is there no limit on how much someone could change, physically and psychologically, before they just don't exist anymore? If you lost all your memories and physically transformed into a wildebeest, surely you would no longer exist. At that point, you're just gone. But if what you really are, essentially, is an immaterial soul, then as long as that soul keeps on keeping on, then yeah, you still exist, even after all that change. Let's say you remained a human being, but you lost all your memories, and every character trait you have was inverted. It's obvious that in some sense, you no longer exist. And when we return to the teletransporter, we'll talk about the distinction between numerical identity and qualitative identity, which I think can make sense of that. But to me, there is something going for both sides here. I do think it's kind of a weird side effect of the non-reductive view of identity that you could be any creature with any psychological profile and still exist. Technically, if God created a world with 7 or 8 billion bees, and all human souls alive now were embodied in those bees, that is, they stood in a reliable set of causal connections with those bodies, you would be a bee. God will still have created you and your mom and Joe Schmid, who has an intimate connection with your mom. So even though the more reductive psychological theories of what you really are have their drawbacks, which we'll come to, they at least get what I think is probably the right result here. Arguably, something essential is missing if we're just a big swarm of bees. If God chose to embody us in that way, he did not really create us. So on one extreme, we have people who are inclined to think that if you change at all, that it can't really be said that you exist. Just like you can't step in the same river twice, you can't change and persist throughout that change. If there is significant change, then you no longer exist. On the other end of the spectrum, you have people who think you could be an alligator. Even if you change to that degree, you could still exist because what you really are is an immaterial soul. And if that soul is embodied in a human body or an alligator body, you still exist in either case. There are moral questions at play too. As Chad Vance put it, the woman presently being punished for some past crime had better be the same person who committed it, or else her punishment is unjust. If I'm obligated to keep a promise, I'd better be the one who made it in the first place, or else I have no such obligation. If you presently possess a car, you'd better be the one who purchased it, or else you have no legitimate claim to its ownership. So I think those pose a few challenges. It's kind of annoying when someone says, oh, here's my philosophical view. Also, this has zero practical implications, and please don't try to apply this to any other area of philosophy or ordinary life. It's like, so what, are we just playing a game or something? At a certain point, I feel like I have to ask whether you really mean what you're saying. Because this notion of a self or a person, it just seems kind of indispensable. Not just in ordinary life, but just for making sense of the world. This talk about teletransporters and alligators might be enough to make you throw up your hands and take seriously the idea that we're just not talking about something real at all. Maybe the self and personhood are convenient fictions, stories we tell ourselves that have no reality beyond our language. Maybe a persistent self just doesn't exist. The no-self view associated with Eastern thought is often controversially attributed to David Hume, whose wider system of empiricism justified his no-self view. Roughly, Hume believed that we have sense impressions on the one hand, and on the other, ideas that form as a consequence. They're sort of faded copies of sense impressions, but we never actually perceive the self, or the person to whom these perceptions are appearing. This is one passage from Hume that is often quoted in these contexts. It must be some one impression that gives rise to every real idea, but self, or person, is not any one impression. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I never can catch myself at any time without a perception, and never can observe anything but the perception. When my perceptions are removed for any time, as by sound sleep, so long am I insensible to myself, and may truly be said not to exist. And were all my perceptions removed by death, and could I neither think nor feel nor see nor love nor hate, after the dissolution of my body, I should be entirely annihilated. nor do I conceive what is farther requisite to make me a perfect non-entity. If anyone, upon serious and unprejudiced reflection, thinks he has a different notion of himself, I must confess I can no longer reason with him. All I can allow him is that he may be in the right, as well as I, and that we are essentially different in this particular. He may perhaps perceive something simple and continued, which he calls himself, though I am certain there is no such principle in me. Like I said, this is one way of resolving some of the puzzles that emerge. Now, it seems counterintuitive to say that I don't exist. But beyond that, when it comes to Hume specifically, I reject his broader empiricist framework. Although I can see why, if I had the same background assumptions as Hume, then I might be drawn to this no-self view, but I don't accept his empiricist framework. Once you have a different method, you end up with solid reasons for believing in yourself, and really no good reason for rejecting it. Just to be honest, it really seems as if I exist. It just really seems like that's an indispensable part of my worldview. And if that ends up leading me to some kind of non-reductive view, where I take on this primitive concept of a self that's justified only through intuition, well then so be it. Okay, so I think it's time we return to the teletransporter. I'm still not getting in that thing. Maybe you disagree, but here are the exact conditions that would need to be satisfied, which could never be satisfied, so I'm never going to get in it. So here's what I would need. I need every single one of my atoms to come along with me. Not just any electrons, I want my electrons. This carbon atom in my head that I'm pointing to right now, I want that one. And I want it in the same exact place. If it's in my brain, I want it in my brain, not in my testicles. So there are two configuration conditions. Obviously, I don't want an arm coming out of my head, but I also want my balls to be my balls. So it has to literally be the same physical material, and it has to be in the exact same arrangement. You might say, oh, don't you physically change over time? Don't you exchange out all your physical matter? Yes, I don't care. That is a part of innumerable biological processes that I don't understand, so I'm not messing with it. And it happens gradually, too, which could be a relevant difference. I'm just not rolling the dice. So if you're some type of monist, then I think that would be enough, right? Same particles in the same configuration. But I have some credence in substance dualism. In that case, my body could change, and as long as it's my soul, then I still exist. So I could afford some wiggle room with the exact same particles and all that on dualism. But I'm still worried about the transporter, because what if my soul stops interacting with my body and a new soul becomes embodied? It has to be my soul, and there's no way anyone, including me, could know that it was still the original soul. Maybe when I'm disassembled and my soul stops interacting with my body, at that point a different soul will come to stand in a reliable set of causal connections with my body, in which case my point of view will have come to a permanent end. The bottom line is I'm not getting in that thing. So Derek Parfit has, by my lights, a completely suicidal view of this. He doesn't even care if it's the same physical material. So you could literally just be killed in the first part of the transportation process, and then a replica walks out on the other side, and he thinks that's you. To my mind, that view is vulnerable to a completely decisive refutation, but he doesn't see it that way. So imagine that you step into the transporter, and instead of being incinerated, it malfunctions. So you're confused and you step outside of it, and the scientists say, oh no, it worked. See, you're on the other side of the planet right now. You just walked out of it. You can see it on screen right now. But the thing that we usually use to kill you didn't work. But don't worry, you're going to die in about 3 hours. Okay, well, in that case, it seems perfectly clear that you're still standing there, and there's a replica of you that's going to go on living. But Parfit doesn't see it that way.
And so Derek thought, no, teletransportation is just a very quick mode of transportation. One doesn't require the same body or the same brain. All that's necessary is that there should be these psychological connections between the person on the pad and the person in the replicator booth on Mars. And for Derek, again, the psychological connections are just similarities of mental states. They don't require any physical continuity or causation, as I persuaded him. And so for Derek, I survive. I don't die. My body's disintegrated, but I'm not my body. I'm the person on Mars. Because as you note, he gave a further variant of that thought experiment in which there's actually a malfunction of the scanning booth. You step on the pad, your body is scanned, the replica is created on Mars. You're a little bit puzzled. You walk outside the scanning booth and the technician tells you, we've had a bit of a glitch in the machine here. It hasn't disintegrated your body, but it has damaged your heart and you're going to die within a few days. But don't worry, there's the replica carrying on Mars. And he was unfazed by this, but it's precisely that kind of variant on the case that persuades me. In my view, I cease to exist when my body is disintegrated. In his example, I just find that overwhelmingly intuitive. And Derek and I talked about this, and it's really very difficult to go deeper than intuition in this kind of case. But what he said to me was this: he and I were both what he called reductionists about personal identity. There's nothing more to my existence than certain relations obtaining between bits of matter over time. And we both agree with that. But for me, it's really compelling that among the relations that have to hold are certain relations of physical and functional continuity of areas of my brain.
I think Parfit just had weird intuitions about this. I will say, though, that Parfit is kind of a genius. I've loved reading Reasons and Persons. I love the way he reasons through the problems, but I just think he bites all the wrong bullets. So now that we're nearing the end of the episode, I suppose now is the perfect time to introduce a crucially important concept that can clear up a lot of confusion, and that is the distinction between numerical identity and qualitative identity. This is Humor and Knowledge, Reality, and Value. Quote, "Now I have to make an important conceptual point to head off a confusion that happens virtually every time you talk about personal identity with a class. There are two senses of identical in English, qualitative identity and numerical identity. A and B are qualitatively identical when they have the same qualitative characteristics. For example, you could have two electrons in a box with equal mass, equal charge, equal energy, and even the same quantum state. There's still two electrons, though, not one. For example, the total mass inside the box would be twice the mass of an electron. Then the electrons are qualitatively, but not numerically, identical. On the other hand, we say that A and B are numerically identical when A just is B. In other words, there's only one object that we're talking about. George Washington is identical with the first president of the United States. They're just two ways of referring to the same person. Of course, numerical identity entails qualitative identity, but not vice versa. George Washington is numerically, and therefore also qualitatively identical, with the first U.S. president. Crucial point for understanding the problem of personal identity, or subject identity. The issue is about numerical identity. We're not asking when A is qualitatively identical to B, which would be trivial. We're asking when A is numerically identical with B, that is, when A and B are one in the same being. So this is my main issue with a lot of psychological continuity theorists, or people who think memory is so very important, because there obviously could be a clone of you with all your memories and all your psychological attributes, and in nearly every sense, that being is identical to you. It is qualitatively identical to you, but it's not numerically identical to you. And that's also why I'm not too big on the idea of mind uploading. Even if we could create a conscious being identical to me that exists on a hard drive or something, it wouldn't really be me. It wouldn't be numerically identical to this person right here. And that brings us to Ralph Stefan Weir's dilemma for transhumanists.
Yeah, so I mean, this is closely related to the debate about personal identity. Transhumanism is a fairly broad church. And at least one of my viewers was totally nonplussed when I suggested that, I've published a couple of papers about this, but at least for the article in Philosophy, one of the reviewers totally nonplussed when I said, like, mind uploading or something like it is a core part of the transhumanist vision. And I had to add a load of references and show this is kind of true. But yeah, at least the core version of this really influential, kind of fascinating, fun, slightly disturbing intellectual tradition known as transhumanism, based mainly in like California and to some degree Oxford, at least until lately, is that technology is progressing fast, and before long, radical human enhancements are going to allow us to totally change our nature, both as a species and as individuals, to such a degree that we will no longer be unambiguously human, and we're going to be able to live indefinitely and have a really great time. And a core move when people have spelled out how exactly this is going to happen is to suggest that we will either have our nervous systems replaced wholesale by artificial components, silicon circuits or whatever, or we will hook our brains up to computers and transfer our minds over from our brains. In one or another way, we will, as it's put, upload our minds onto computers. And now, I didn't ever particularly intend to write a whole bunch of stuff about transhumanism, but I got invited to some conferences and things and just ended up doing so. And it seems to me that there's an important inconsistency in the way that this idea is ordinarily presented. And this is because when transhumanists advertise this brilliant technological utopia where you're going to have a completely upgraded mind and body, they make it very clear that it's going to be you who gets to enjoy all of this. They appeal to our everyday assumption that there's a deep sense in which we survive over time, and it can really be me who gets to have all of that. And there's at least a plausible argument put forward by Derek Parfit for thinking that that thesis that you really survive over time in a deep sense requires something like the ego view of personal identity or substance dualism or what's sometimes called the simple view. However, when transhumanists turn to the question of why we should be confident that it's possible to survive having one's mind uploaded to a computer, they have a tendency to appeal to the thesis that there's nothing more to personal identity than a pattern of causation and similarity between an organism at an earlier date and an organism, or perhaps computer, at a later date. And they quite often appeal to Derek Parfit when they make that move, because he's the most influential proponent of that view. However, as Parfit himself stresses, if that's right, at least according to him, there is no deep sense in which you survive over time. And although we can talk about it still being you in the future, it isn't you in any sense you can rationally care about. Now, obviously, if that were the case, that would totally undermine the transhumanist advertising campaign where it's meant to be really you in a deep sense. Mm-hmm. Now, it's really important that there are people who agree with Parfit that personal identity is reducible to these patterns of causation and continuity, but who have tried to defend the view that it still matters, it's still you in an important sense. In my work on this, I've urged that, well, I actually find those arguments very unconvincing, but even if they succeed, they are arguments to which transhumanists can't appeal, because they presuppose that the kind of radical changes that mind uploading, etc., would involve are not available to us. So in short, I think transhumanism here plausibly can be accused of committing a kind of bait and switch. When they're putting forward the idea of this techno-utopia, they're presupposing one understanding of personal identity, but when they explain how it's possible, they switch to another. These two views are incompatible, so the transhumanist idea, as usually presented, is self-contradictory. I think there might be some awareness of this in the transhumanist movement. I'd love to claim credit for that, but I think it's pretty implausible. But I claim it nonetheless. It seems to me in like Kurzweil's last book that came out last year, he's still saying it's important, it's really you, but he sort of acknowledges it's a bit unclear whether it will be. This is a difficult problem. And then in Bostrom's latest book, a great book, I think, what's it called? Like Deep Utopia, quite kind of bizarre book, but full of interesting stuff. He kind of has moved away from the idea that it's really going to be you. He focuses on other stuff. I wonder, I'm not sure, but I wonder if the faith in mind uploading isn't going to diminish over the next few years, or hasn't started to do so already. There's a realization that at least we don't have good grounds to be confident that it's going to be you in all the sense worth caring about.
Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.